Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, College of William & Mary professor Andrew Fisher examines the first conservation effort in American history to protect forest from rampant logging and hydraulic mining. During the Progressive Era from 1901 through 1909, President Theodore Roosevelt worked with Gifford Pinchot, the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service, to set aside more than 150 million acres of land to be under federal government control. This land was designated for national parks and responsible logging. This class is an hour and 20 minutes.
One of the major themes in this course is the history of American environmental thought, American conceptions of nature, and the policies that have governed, especially our public lands. As we've seen up to this point in the semester, during America's headlong expansion into the Trans-Missouri West, very few people took into consideration the impacts of their activities on nature. They didn't pay much attention to the environment generally. And in fact, environmentalism wasn't even a word yet, and it wouldn't be until the 1950s. So what we're talking about today is not the environmental movement as you think of it today. Rather, we're talking about conservation, because the first Americans to worry about and respond to signs of environmental degradation, particularly in the West, styled themselves conservationists. And their movement differed in significant ways from the modern environmental movement that we're familiar with today. So from this point, we'll be tracing the evolution of American environmental thought and policy in the 20th and into the 21st centuries. Conservation was a national movement. It's not simply about the West. This is actually a picture of Bird Day, I think, in Philadelphia. And you can see all the people have gathered. The first 500 women, I think, got free hats. You can see they've all got very nice hats on. Everyone has trees and American flags. And so what they're going to do is go plant those trees to provide homes for birds. And birds, as we'll talk about, were one of the things that especially Progressive Era women were concerned about, the fate of birds, many of whom ended up on their hats. So we'll talk a little bit about women's hats and fashion in the Progressive Era. So conservation is a national concern, but the West is particularly significant in the formation of the movement. The West was central to many of its concerns, because the West was then and now associated with wilderness, and the West had, particularly as a result of the progressive conservation movement, the most public lands in the United States. You'll also see in our lecture today another major theme that we've traced in this course, which is federal power in the West and Western resentment of that, especially among rural Westerners. People resenting the amount of land that the federal government had under its control and resenting the policies that it implemented in order to govern the use of natural resources. So that theme of dependence and denial you'll also see coming out towards the end of this lecture. Conservation as a social and political movement emerged during the Progressive Era of the late 19th and early 20th century. The Progressive Era is roughly bounded by 1890 and 1920, although historians like to argue about that incessantly. So when I talk about the Progressive Era, we're talking about roughly the period from the 1890s to the 1920s, which was characterized, as you know from your general study of American history, by growing concern, particularly among middle-class white Americans, about a variety of social problems and political problems that were associated with the changes that the United States had undergone since the Civil War. Industrialization, urbanization, and immigration in particular were changing the United States. The United States was becoming a nation of cities and industry rather than of farmers and small towns. And there were a lot of stresses and strains associated with that. By the 1890s, some Americans were beginning to confront the limits of their nation. We talked about the Turner thesis and how in 1890, Frederick Jackson Turner had said the frontier was closed and all the free land was gone. Well, this closure of the frontier appeared to be mimicked or reflected in the fate of many of the species and landscapes that had defined the wide open frontier. Passenger pigeons, which had been once so numerous they blackened the skies in parts of the United States, had been pushed over the edge of extinction through overhunting and habitat destruction. The same thing had nearly happened to the bison, or the buffalo, which were one of the most iconic symbols of the West. By the 1880s, they had nearly been pushed over the brink of extinction. Even the noble jackalope had disappeared, now found only in museums or places like Waldrug, where I took this picture. You can see jackalopes once got so large that you could ride them. It's true, but no more. Don't write that down. There's no such thing as a jackalope. But yeah, just a shameless plug for my vacation photos. There was also evidence on the landscape itself of the wreckage that industrial capitalism had made in much of the West. We talked about hydraulic mining in California, which had literally washed away hillsides and deposited them in streams. There were growing fears in America of a timber famine that would deprive the United States of the lumber that it needed to continue its urban industrial expansion. So Americans were becoming slowly, and as we'll see, it was contested, but they were becoming more aware of waste and the potential for the exhaustion of the resources that had blessed them, particularly in the West. Oops, got to go back. The progressive conservation movement also expressed typically progressive concerns about industrial power in the form of the modern corporation. Many progressives in this period were worried about the excesses of industrialization, about growing concentrations of wealth and power in the hands of robber barons like John D. Rockefeller and his corporation Standard Oil, which you see here depicted as a giant octopus. Very popular depiction of corporations and trusts in this period. You can see Standard Oil reaching out to grasp the White House, the Capitol building, inserting itself into politics. We're very familiar with these concerns today, but they first emerged in the late 19th and early 20th century. A lot of people were indignant about these changes and worried about the decline of individual opportunity in America. So this naturally ties into concerns about resources and whether natural resources were there for the benefit of the people or they were there for the exploitation of the interests. So a very progressive era concern with the people versus the interests and the need of the government in particular to control or regulate private industry in order to protect the public good. So the progressive conservation movement reflects this era's faith in the state at all levels, from state governments up to the federal government, their faith in the state and in science as ways of improving society and curbing the ills of industrialization. Progressives believed in rational planning. Progressives believed in experts who studied problems and found solutions and informed the policies that govern society. Progressives also believed that government in general, and increasingly the federal government, had to be strong and had to be active in order to prevent abuses of society and of nature that individuals alone could not. The government was the only effective counterweight to the modern corporation. So the conservation movement is very much in keeping with other progressive social and political concerns, including the growing assertiveness of women. As you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, women, particularly white, middle, and upper class women, became increasingly assertive in the public sphere. But they did so by building on traditional arguments about the role of women in society. Women, it was held, were morally superior beings whose primary job was to keep the home as a refuge for men who would go out and do battle in the world of politics and business and then come home to a nurturing environment where children would also be socialized and moral virtues instilled. So women, this is the cult of domesticity that goes back, you know, earlier in the 19th century, had this traditional role as keepers of the home. But in the 19th century, women had increasingly inserted themselves outside the public, outside the private sphere in a variety of ways through movements like the fight for temperance and prohibition, abolitionism, and increasingly suffrage. Women began arguing that in order to fulfill their traditional roles as protectors of American virtue, they needed to have a voice in the political sphere, because a lot of the problems that crept into the home, like alcoholism and so forth, were, they said, things that could be remedied through public policy. And so in order to effectively protect the home, women had to have some say in the policies that govern society in general. Also, by the late 19th century, middle and upper class women are gaining increasing freedom from household labor. One of the signifiers of middle class status in this period was to have domestic servants who liberated these women from having to do a lot of the drudgery of cooking and cleaning and doing the laundry and so forth. And so they had more free time. And what did they do with their free time? Increasingly, things like gardening, botanizing, bird watching, and camping, going out into parks or wilderness areas and recreating. They had the means, they had the time, and they increasingly tied the ability to do those things to their quality of life, to a middle and upper class standard of living. So you can see how they become concerned about the state of the natural world and begin to connect the natural world to their homes, saying that in order to protect true womanhood, in order to protect the home, in order to protect children, in order to improve society, women have to become involved in the crusade for conservation. And progressive women did support the conservation movement in a variety of ways, working especially through groups like the General Confederation of Women's Clubs and its state and local affiliates. All over the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, middle and upper class progressive women gravitated to these clubs, which spoke for women and engaged them in a variety of reform causes, whether it was the fight against child labor, or, you know, for protective legislation for women to limit the amount of time they could work, to conservation. In places like California, where this quote comes from, women's clubs threw themselves into the fight for things like forestry protection and the setting aside of parks and wilderness areas. And you can see in this quote from, well, she wasn't that liberated. She calls herself Mrs. Robert Burdett. Mrs. Robert Burdett of the California Federation of Women's Clubs said, "The preservation of the forests of this state is a matter that should appeal to women. While the women of New Jersey are saving the Palisades of the Hudson from utter destruction by men, to whose greedy souls Mount Sinai is only a stone quarry, and the women of Colorado are saving the cliff dwellings and Pueblo ruins of their state from vandal destruction, the word comes to the women of California that men, whose souls are gang saws, are meditating the turning of our world-famous sequoias into planks and fencing worth so many dollars. And there you see illustrated this sort of traditional argument about the moral superiority of women in society, that men are blinded by greed and competition to the other values of nature, that women, with their superior sensibilities, can appreciate and therefore must help protect. So women working through their clubs and various other organizations did things like lobby for the protection of California sequoias. They lobbied for the creation of state parks and national parks. They did things like engage in civic beautification projects, creating parks and green belts in American cities to bring the blessings of nature to the growing urban immigrant masses who didn't have the means to get out into the wilderness. They also joined Audubon Society clubs, and some of them began to argue against the fashion sense of the day, particularly the use of large amounts of plumage, including, as you can see, entire birds in women's hats. This was the height of fashion in the late 19th, early 20th century, but it was enormously destructive of both wild and domestic bird populations. Particularly rare species like snowy egrets and herons were being slaughtered by the tens of thousands to provide plumage for ladies' fashions. So women also argue against people of their own sex, trying to convince them that conservation of these species trumps the need for a fashionable hat. The point here is that women are integral to the conservation movement, and they're generally left out because all of the focus is placed on elite men, and especially Theodore Roosevelt. This is not without reason, though, because arguably no one was more influential in articulating and advancing the goals of progressive conservation than T.R. or Teddy, or the situation, as some of his friends call them. He was, yeah, that's a little known fact. You're gonna hear some more little known facts about Teddy here in a moment. But Theodore Roosevelt becomes the poster boy for progressive conservation and the most important political figure in advancing that agenda. He also, as you can see, had a way with birds in the way of Disney princesses. I did not Photoshop this. I got this out of a newspaper article. Just a little background on T.R., who became president in 1901 after William McKinley was assassinated. Teddy Roosevelt grew up in upstate New York, and as a child, he was sickly and weak. But he overcame his weakness, he said, through the strenuous life. And throughout his life, he was a firm believer in the virtues of the outdoors and of exercise. And so you'll see why he becomes interested in national parks and in conservation. He also had a bit of an image problem when he entered politics in the 1880s. In 1882, at the tender age of 23, Roosevelt, who came from a wealthy Republican family in New York State, he became the youngest member of the New York State Assembly. But he didn't get much respect, particularly from Democratic legislators, those associated with the Tammany Hall machine. They ridiculed him and repeatedly, in not so subtle ways, as you'll see, attacked his manhood. And I'll read you a quote. Daily newspapers lampooned Roosevelt as the quintessence of effeminacy. They nicknamed him weakling Jane Dandy, Punkin Lily, and the exquisite Mr. Roosevelt. They ridiculed his high voice, tight pants, and fancy clothing. Several began referring to him by the name of the well-known homosexual Oscar Wilde, and one actually alleged, in a less than veiled allusion, that Roosevelt was, quote, given to sucking the knob of an ivory cane. Although he was normally restrained in dealing with his political opponents, Roosevelt lost it one day when he heard a rumor that Tammany Hall legislators were plotting to toss him in a blanket in the style of, you know, Sancho Panza in Don Quixote. And he lost his temper and he marched up to this Tammany legislator and said, "By God, if you try anything like that, I'll kick you, I'll bite you, I'll kick you in the balls. I'll do anything to you. You'd better leave me alone." And this is where I wonder if C-SPAN 3 has censorship rules or not. But anyway, the point is, Roosevelt had an image problem, which, as we know in American politics, can be deadly. What saves him is the West. After the untimely death of his wife and mother on the same day in 1884, a devastated Roosevelt temporarily left politics, and he lit out for the territories. He went to what is now North Dakota, and he spent 2 years between 1883 and 1884 as a rancher and a sheriff. And when he came back, he had rebranded himself, no pun intended. You know, we talk about rebranding all the time in politics, or rebooting. He rebooted himself, if you will. And you can see here, he said, "I owe more than I can ever express to the West." The man who had been derided by Tammany legislators as the quintessence of effeminacy came back as a cowboy, and he even posed as a cowboy here in his hat and chaps. He said, "It would electrify some of my friends who have accused me of representing the kid glove element in politics if they could see me galloping over the plains day in and day out, clad in buckskin shirt and leather chaparajos." I believe, actually, if you refer to chaps as chaparajos in the West today, you will get punched in the face by an actual cowboy. But he said, "With a big sombrero on my head, for good, healthy exercise, I would strongly recommend some of our gilded youth go West and try a short course of riding, bucking ponies, and assist at the branding of a lot of Texas steers." So Roosevelt used the West to recreate himself as a rugged, individualistic man. And he becomes particularly concerned for the rest of his career about protecting some of the vestiges of the frontier so that other hyper-civilized, effeminate men in the cities could also have this opportunity. Roosevelt later read the Turner Thesis, and he enthusiastically agreed with Frederick Jackson Turner's conclusions about the importance of the frontier in American history. His own historical writings, which are quoted in part here, in books like The Winning of the West, touted the American vision of conquest and civilization that Turner had written about. You can see there, he said, "The West would never have been settled save for the fierce courage and the eager desire to brave danger so characteristic of the stalwart backwoodsman." In an article published the same year that Turner read his thesis, T.R. went on to say, "In a perfectly peaceful and commercial civilization, there is always a danger of laying too little stress upon the more virile virtues, upon the virtues which go to make up a race of statesmen and soldiers, of pioneers and explorers. These are the very qualities which are fostered by vigorous, manly, out-of-door sports, such as mountaineering, big game hunting, riding, shooting, rowing, football, and kindred games." So, at least parts of the old frontier, he believed, should be saved so that people like him could go out and test their mettle against the wilderness as hunters or what have you. And there you see him playing the part of the stalwart backwoodsman in the style of Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett with his big hunting knife and his Indian attire. Another part of Roosevelt's commitment to conservation came out of his desire to preserve American strength and to build America's role in the world. As you can see in the quote here, Roosevelt tied the conservation of America's natural resources to economic strength and independence. He said, "It is safe to say that the prosperity of our people depends on the energy and intelligence with which our natural resources are used. It is equally clear that these resources are the final basis of national power and perpetuity." So, for the man who believed in speaking softly and carrying a big stick and sent the Great White Fleet around the world to demonstrate America's naval power, the conservation of natural resources was about preserving America's strength and ensuring that it could dominate at least its own hemisphere and also extend its influences in places like Asia. So Roosevelt's interests in conservation are complex. They mingle his personal views with his political views. And he becomes a staunch advocate for conservation programs, from the expansion of America's National Forest Reserves to the creation of national parks to reclamation. And today we're going to be talking about the National Forests and Wildlife Refuge System. If we have time, we'll get into reclamation. But first, we have to talk about Pinchot's right-hand man in all of this, Gifford Pinchot. Gifford Pinchot shared a similar background to T.R. He was not a Harvard man, he was a Yalie. But they overcame that difference because they agreed about a lot of other things, particularly the importance of conservation. Like Roosevelt, Pinchot was the child of a wealthy Northeastern family. He studied forestry at Yale. He loved the woods. He loved to go for walks in the woods to skinny dip. And he also enjoyed boxing and wrestling with Teddy Roosevelt. Even when he was in the White House, they would occasionally get together and go a few rounds. And I like to envision them kind of like, you guys know Inspector Clouseau? This is not Steve Martin, but the classic Peter Sellers Inspector Clouseau and his manservant Cato. And Inspector Clouseau would order Cato to attack him, you know, periodically by surprise to keep him sharp. And so I like to imagine, you know, TR going into the Oval Office and saying, "Okay, Pinchot," and then Pinchot comes swinging through the window and they roll around on the floor. Yes, this is how I amuse myself. But there is some speculation that Pinchot and TR founded Fight Club. The quote there on the bottom, "Hit me as hard as you can," is, as historians say, apocryphal, meaning we don't know whether he actually said it. But of course, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. So it will remain forever a matter of speculation. What we do know is that Pinchot and TR worked hand in hand to advanced conservation, and particularly forestry protection, which was near and dear to Pinchot's heart. Pinchot supported TR's policies as the head of the Division of Forestry, what becomes the Forest Service, initially within the Department of the Interior, and then later in the Department of Agriculture. So he works, as we'll see, hand in glove with TR to protect more and more of America's forests. Like TR, though, he's not a simple nature lover, not a tree hugger, as people sometimes, you know, call environmentalists today. On the contrary, he had a thoroughly anthropocentric, meaning human-centered, and utilitarian conception of nature. And this is important to grasp because it's at the heart of the difference between progressive conservation and modern environmentalism. And I'll explain what I mean more in a moment. But at its base, at its root, for Pinchot, conservation was, and you can see this, the application of common sense to the common problems for the common good. So he drew on Bentham's utilitarian idea of the greatest good for the greatest number. And Pinchot added, as you'll see, for the longest time. Now let me pause there for a moment and ask if there are any questions that you guys have about what we've covered so far. Okay, all right. Don't be shy. It's just C-SPAN 3. Gosh, probably shouldn't. Anyway. all right, my apologies to all the viewers out there. Okay, no questions? All right. I just blew my gig. Anyway, a historian named Samuel Hayes has called Pinchot's ideas about conservation and nature the gospel of efficiency, which had, according to Hayes, three core principles, which really illustrate what I mean when I say his conception of nature and resource use was thoroughly utilitarian and anthropocentric. The first principle of the gospel of efficiency, and efficiency was a big progressive era concern, was development. Nature, according to Pinchot and most other conservationists, was there to be used. Timber, water, grass, whatever you're talking about, whatever resource was out there, was there to be used. And as you can see there, you know, he did not see development in and of itself as a bad thing. The right to the present generation, of the present generation, to the fullest necessary use of all resources with which this country is so abundantly blessed. Even more striking is the second statement, which said, there may be just as much waste in neglecting the development and use of certain resources as there is in their destruction. So not cutting marketable timber, not damming rivers, not using water and letting it flow untapped to the sea, that was wasteful. And we talked about this last time when we discussed Los Angeles' acquisition of the Owens River, and how William Mulholland, the director of LA's water system, you know, said of Yosemite, I would, you know, go out and take pictures of this place, put them in books, give them to libraries all over the world, and then I'd go in there and build a dam and stop the goddamn waste. The progressive conservationist idea of protecting nature is to protect it for future development, for sustainable development, we might call it today. And this leads to the second principle, closely related to the first, the prevention of waste. Pinchot and TR and their supporters recognize that America's development of its natural resources, like timber, up to this point, had been profoundly wasteful, and that this waste imperiled America's economic and political greatness if it was not checked. So resources should be used efficiently and conserved. There's the word, conservation. Conserved for future use as a matter of good business and also of national interest. You know, that there was nothing to be gained by allowing timber companies to go out and cut down every last tree, because then ultimately they would go out of business and the United States would be bereft of timber, and then where would we be? So Pinchot said, there has come gradually in this country an understanding that waste is not a good thing and that the attack on waste is an industrial necessity. The natural resources must be developed and preserved for the benefit of the many, there's the utilitarian Benthamite conception again, and not merely for the profit of a few. The outgrowth of conservation, the inevitable result, is national efficiency. In the great commercial struggle between nations, which is eventually to determine the welfare of all, national efficiency will be the deciding factor. In those quotes, you see here illustrated some of the things I was talking about earlier. The progressive concerns with unchecked industrial and corporate power. The people versus the interests, the few versus the many. You also see the concern with preserving America's position in the world. National efficiency being the key to national greatness in the struggle between nations. Finally, you see the mantra that comes to govern Pinchot's conception of conservation. Conservation means the greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time. That is why, as we talked about last time, when faced with the battle between Los Angeles and the Owens Valley farmers and ranchers over the Owens River, he sides with Los Angeles. He sides with the city, which contains more people, the greatest good for the greatest number, for the longest time. Oops. The third and final principle of this gospel of efficiency was the improvement. Oh, technology. The improvement of nature. Progressive conservationists firmly believe that human beings, using science and the other gifts that God had given them, could improve upon God's work in many ways. Again, Pinchot said, the first duty of the human race is to control the earth it lives upon. So again, anthropocentrism is central to progressive conservationism. The second quote from Teddy Roosevelt illustrates what I'm talking about in a concrete way. The forest alone, he said, cannot fully regulate and conserve the waters of the arid region. So nature, in other words, can't do this work on its own. Stupid nature. Great storage works are necessary to equalize the flow of streams and to save the flood waters. The pictures on the left are of the Klamath Basin before and after reclamation projects transformed it into from an arid region an arid desert into a patchwork of farms and ranches. It's the application of human engineering and scientific expertise to problems that progressive conservationists perceived with the way nature worked. Certain landscapes, particularly deserts, they thought, were almost perverse in that they didn't have enough water or other resources to support the kind of activities human beings wanted to carry out there. So one of the jobs of government, as T.R. and Pinchot saw it, was to bring government support to these places and make them bloom. We'll talk about reclamation later. I don't know if we'll get to it today, but we will talk about reclamation later, and we'll come back to it very close to the end of the semester in the Klamath Basin, where we'll look at how some of these tensions over competing conceptions of nature and competing uses of it play out in the 21st century. But first, we'll turn to protecting forests and wildlife. The National Forest System and the National Wildlife Refuges, which were particularly near and dear to the hearts of Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt. Pinchot, as I've said, was a forester. He'd been trained as a forester. He grew up loving the woods, and he believed that America's forests were in great danger of disappearing due to rampant overcutting. When we talked about earlier in the semester how America's timber industry had migrated across the continent, first from New England to the Midwest, and then by the turn of the 20th century, from the Midwest to the Northwest. And everywhere it went, there was abundant evidence of wastefulness and greed gone wild in the form of cut-over forests that had not been replanted. So the general practice of the timber industry at this time was to cut and run. Pinchot wanted to confront this problem. And in 1898, he assumed control of the nation's growing system of forest reserves. In the 1890s, Congress had passed two laws that sought to prevent a timber famine and check the abuses of industrial forestry. The first was the 1891 General Land Law Revision Act, which, as you can see, authorized presidential withdrawals of land from the public domain for national forest reserves. Remember, the public domain is all that land out there, especially in the West, that is ostensibly open for homesteading or for other uses like ranching. Starting in 1891, the federal government begins to withdraw some acreage in forested areas to set aside as reserves. And by 1897, there were more than 39 million acres in reserves, primarily, as you can see, in the Trans-Missouri West. It will later be expanded to the east. Under this initial act, however, there was no administrative agency to oversee the national forest system. So there was no Forest Service yet, which meant that many of the abuses that the forest reserves were meant to prevent, like timber theft and homestead fraud, went on unchecked. This prompted a second act in 1897, the 1897 Forest Organic Act, which created the U.S. Forest Service, a new federal land management agency, which remains quite powerful in the West to this day. The Forest Organic Act also renamed the forest reserves national forests. So you have the beginnings of the national forest system that we're familiar with. And it gave the Forest Service broad authority to regulate the use of public forests, from logging to mining to ranching. So even before Gifford Pinchot takes control of the system, there is a growing federal commitment to setting aside some land, at least temporarily, to protect it from development and over-exploitation. Pinchot, after assuming control of the Forest Service, set out to strengthen it and to expand the system. And he was extremely passionate about this. It was, he felt, his life's work. And he was overjoyed when Teddy Roosevelt became president, and he had an ally in the White House who shared his concerns about the state of the national forests and his determination to do something. In 1905, Pinchot convinced Roosevelt to have the forest reserves and the Forest Service transferred from the Department of the Interior to the Department of Agriculture. Any idea why he would do that? Yeah, Tim.
To stop these forested lands being claimed for agricultural purposes. If it's under the hood of the Department of Agriculture, then they have more regulation and control over what can be grown there, if anything can be grown there.
Right, right. The General Land Office, which at this time was distributing homesteads, you know, by the thousands, is located in Interior. And so Pinchot hoped that transferring the Forest Service from Interior to Agriculture would insulate the Forest Service and the Forest Reserves from homesteading pressure, which, as we'll see, he viewed as one of the greatest threats to the integrity of the system. It also, though, reflected his view that trees were a crop, that if practiced responsibly, forestry could be a sustainable, renewable industry. And so treat forests like other crops, hence the Department of Agriculture, seems to make sense. Under Pinchot's watch, the Forest Service became increasingly professionalized. Initially, you know, there weren't a lot of people on the ground who knew much about how forests worked or about how to manage them. Pinchot makes it his business to go to forestry schools like Yale, where he'd come out, and find the best and brightest young men and hire them as rangers to go west and help protect the new forest reserve system. They were dubbed little GPs, little Gifford Pinchots. And a lot of local Westerners disdained them, viewed them as snot-nosed Ivy League greenhorns who didn't really know how to survive out west and didn't have any business telling ranchers and loggers and others who use the forest how to do their business. So you see the beginnings of this tension we've seen before between the federal government and locals in the west over how to use the landscapes and the resources of the region. So these rangers, when they go out west, often faced intense local hostility, as well as enduring isolation. I mean, you can't get much more isolated than sitting in a fire tower on top of a mountain by yourself. They endured isolation, the rigors of the climate in mountainous western areas, and also poor, irregular pay. Particularly when Pinchot's opponents in Congress began trying to block his efforts by cutting appropriations for the Forest Service. A lot of rangers went for months at a time without getting paid. And on occasion, Pinchot dipped into his own considerable personal fortune to pay the rangers. That's how firmly he believed in it. And he counted on young men who also firmly believed in the cause of conservation and the cause of protecting America's national forests. From its beginnings, the Forest Service was governed by the notion of multiple use. And if you drive into a national forest today, you'll often see on the sign, land of many uses. So as the Forest Service conceived of these reserves, they would support not only future timber cutting, but also logging. I mean, well, that is timber cutting, isn't it? Logging, timber cutting, same thing. Logging, grazing, mining, and as you get into the 20s and 30s, increasingly recreation is added to the list of multiple uses that the Forest Service wants to protect. Throughout the 20th century, though, the Forest Service's main priority was logging. And the Forest Service sets itself up as a contractor that private lands begin to be cut over, sells public timber to logging companies, issues contracts to cut public timber. The Forest Service also facilitates logging through things like road building, and you can see a road building crew in the upper left there, and fire suppression. So from its inception, the Forest Service is all about protecting forests for future use, and especially for future use by the logging industry. So it's somewhat strange, it might seem, that there's so much intense hostility towards the Forest Service in its early years on the part of logging corporations and rural Westerners. Rural Roosevelt and Pinchot, during the first 10 years or so of the 20th century, greatly expanded the national forest system, using the powers of the executive branch. Between 1901 and 1909, Roosevelt added 150 million acres to the existing national forest system, 150 million acres between 1901 and 1909. The Forest Service in this period also implemented a system of grazing permits to regulate ranching, which, as we've talked about before, on the public domain had been largely unregulated. People just used the public domain as a vast grazing commons. So the federal government, through the Forest Service, is beginning to exert greater control over a system that is growing. And this prompts a backlash, particularly among Western politicians and their constituents, who fear that what the federal government is doing through the Forest Service is locking up resources that they need to prosper. You can see in the first quote from Pinchot, "We had the power, as we had the duty, to protect the reserves for the use of the people, and that meant stepping on the toes of the biggest interests in the West. From that time on, it was fight, fight, fight." The other quotes are from Western politicians, or Midwestern politicians, like Joseph Cannon from Illinois, who saw this not only as injurious to economic enterprise, but also as overreaching on the part of the president. And they tried to block him through a variety of means. In 1907, for example, Senator Weldon Heyburn, who you see there on the upper left, and his allies in Congress introduced a rider to a spending bill that took away the president's power to create new national forests without congressional approval. What TR and Pinchot had been doing was using executive orders to withdraw more and more acreage and put it into national forests. So Heyburn and friends wanted to put a stop to this by making this subject to congressional approval. TR and Pinchot responded by taking the week before the bill had to be signed to withdraw an additional 16 million acres in six Western states. They said, okay, fine. We'll let you have a say in the creation of new national forest reserves. But in the meantime, they literally spread out maps of the West and identified areas, additional areas that could be protected. And needless to say, Weldon Heyburn and his allies were not amused. Heyburn blasted these withdrawals as midnight reserves, and he threatened to cut off any funds that would publicize them. He said, okay, fine, you create those reserves, we're just not going to tell people they exist. And so people will continue to trespass on them, will continue to file homestead claims on them, and so forth. Heyburn also called the Forest Service treasonous and unconstitutional in speeches on the Senate floor, saying that, you know, TR and the Forest Service and Pinchot had overstepped the bounds of their authority constitutionally. Heyburn loved to grill Pinchot in hearings in Congress. He'd call him to committee meetings and tried to block or reduce appropriations for the Forest Service throughout this period in order to hamstring what Pinchot was trying to do. In 1910, after TR had left office, Pinchot got the axe. TR's successor, President Taft, was much more conservative and less on board with the whole conservationist mission. And he appointed a new Secretary of the Interior, Richard Ballinger, who began reversing many of TR's policies and actually began removing millions of acres from the national forest system and returning it to private use. When Pinchot complained about this, including to T.R. himself, but also to people in Congress, he provoked the ire of Taft and Bollinger, and ultimately he was dismissed. And his dismissal, combined with what T.R. saw as the betrayal of his legacy, actually provoked his abortive return to politics in 1912. T.R. had retired, he went off to Africa on safari and was hunting, and he was so upset about what was going on with the national forest system that he had created that he tried to come back out of retirement, Michael Jordan-like. I don't know. People even get Michael Jordan references anymore, I don't know. But he tried to come back and actually ran for president again in 1912 on the Bull Moose ticket as a progressive Republican, running against Taft, the conservative Republican candidate, and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat. As you know, he did not win. He did manage to spoil the election for Taft and ensure the election of Wilson. But that is how strongly he felt about his legacy as a conservationist. And that is how important conservation was as a national political issue at the time. So there is pushback in Washington, in the halls of power, against the conservationist agenda. There is also pushback on the ground from rural Westerners who opposed in a variety of ways what they also saw as an overreaching federal government that was trying to lock up resources that they wanted to use. Forest rangers were on the front lines of this confrontation, and they were in charge of trying to keep a variety of groups out of the national forest reserves that had been created. As you can see in the first quote, homestead fraud was a huge problem. One Idaho resident said, homesteading was not farming in those days, but just a subterfuge to gain possession of timber on land that has since proven worthless for farming. Most of these forest reserves are in the West in mountainous areas. And some of the ones that I'm going to be talking about here as examples were in the Rockies. Not really great land for farming. Bad soil, short growing season, rocks, bears, you know, what have you. Not easy to farm, but it was very profitable to go in and stake a homestead claim and then flip it. Flip it for cash to someone else, often a timber company that planned to cut it. People could make in this period about $8,000 on the sale of a 160-acre homestead within a national forest reserve. And that's $8,000 in, you know, early 20th century money, a pretty good size fortune. So you had rampant homestead fraud, and you even have the growth of whole communities inside areas that had been staked out as forest reserves. Places like Grand Forks, Montana, and Avery, Idaho, which you see here. That's Avery on top, and Grand Forks on the bottom. These towns were truly Wild West communities in all the ways we usually think of, with saloons and brothels and gunfights and unsavory frontier characters. In Taft, Idaho, they estimate there was one prostitute for every three men and a murder rate higher than New York City. So it was a wild and woolly place. Grand Forks, on one occasion, nearly burned to the ground when a prostitute murdered her client, and then in an effort to disguise the crime, set fire to the bed, and the hotel burned down. And rather than fight the fire, local residents pulled out beer kegs and sat on them and watched it burn. So if you decide to watch for your film review assignment, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, you'll recognize this sort of scene where they're not really that concerned with saving the town after all. This is not what Gifford Pinchot had in mind when he thought about multiple uses for the national forests, saloons and brothels and so forth. So he ordered his forest rangers, like Joe Halm, to shut them down. And you can see they struggle repeatedly with trying to chase these people out, only to have them return. In 1909, when Halm tried to arrest an illegal saloon keeper, the barkeep picked up a shotgun and threatened to kill him. So Halm chose, you know, the better part of valor and withdrew, but he came back with backup in the form of an armed posse of six rangers. And he arrested the barkeep. But on the train trip to the next town over, the barkeep jumped out the window and disappeared into the woods. And they later discovered that he was a convicted felon. So this was the kind of element that the little GPs were up against in trying to make the forest reserves into actual protected spaces. Any questions? Let me stop there for a second. Yeah, Brian.
So did the forest rangers do like both research and policing in those days?
They research is something that will develop in fits and starts over the course of the 20th century. In these early years, most of their time, they're thin on the ground. And most of their time is consumed with fighting problems like homestead fraud and illegal settlements in the national forests, fighting fire, and protecting the timber generally. And also, as we'll talk about, administering grazing leases and so forth. But the science of forestry is advancing throughout the 20th century, and the Forest Service begins developing research stations and so forth for that purpose. Less to study the forest as an ecosystem, more focused on silviculture, on growing timber as efficiently as possible for the market. So it's not until after World War II that you really have a robust sort of research effort focused on ecosystems, forest ecosystems, rather than seeing them as vast timber plantations. Any other questions? Yeah.
Where does John Muir come into play? Is he that big? Is he a big of a deal as people make him out?
The short answer is he is a big deal, and we'll talk about him on Tuesday when we get into the preservation wing of the conservation movement. He is more active. He's actually friends with TR and Pinchot. He camps with them and hikes with them. And they shared a lot of the same interests, particularly in the national parks like Yosemite. But as we'll see, they ultimately part ways over the fate of Hetch Hetchy, which was then part of Yosemite National Park. Because Muir wanted to protect it as a recreational space, as a wilderness area. And TR and Pinchot sided with San Francisco, which wanted to dam it for a water supply. So we will talk about Muir. And Muir, incidentally, although he was Scottish, hated sheep. And he called them hoofed locusts, which is quite a journey for a Scotsman, you know, in this period, you know, to go from, you know, a place where there are more sheep than people in some places, to hating them. It was in the mountains of the Sierras where he witnessed not only the impact of sheep, but hydraulic mining, that Muir came to his passionate idea of wilderness as a refuge that needed to be protected. Yeah, Paul.
You said that the Forest Service contracted these lands out to some of the logging companies. What would make the homestead fraud more attractive to logging companies than actually just going through the Forest Service and contracting?
Well, in this period, the early years of the Forest Service, large timber companies like Weyerhaeuser have so much private land that they don't actually need public forests. And so one of the ironies is that a lot of the big logging companies support the creation of the forest reserve system because it eliminates smaller competitors. They've got all this, they've got, you know, I think we said 900,000 acres in the case of Weyerhaeuser that they can cut. Actually, I have more than that. It was just their first purchase. So they don't worry as much about public forests until later, when private land, when the amount of timber on private land has decreased to the point that they want access to the national forest. But a lot of the big lumbermen were confident that with their connections and their business savvy, they could negotiate access to the public forest when the time came. It's actually a lot of smaller logging operations and people like ranchers and homesteaders who are most opposed in this period to creating forest reserves. And so the irony is that they say, you know, the government and the big corporations are shutting us out. This is not democratic, but rather the opposite. So when the Forest Service becomes increasingly involved in the sale of public timber, as you get into the 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah. Where does the like profit go from the sale of this timber? Does it go like back to the Forest Service?
There's the public treasury. But one of the controversial issues that emerges later, in especially the second half of the 20th century down to today, are below cost timber sales, where the amount of money the federal government through the Forest Service spends to facilitate access to the timber by building roads and culverts, for example, the amount of money the federal government spends exceeds the amount they're paid in stumpage fees by the company. So it amounts to a subsidy, which, well, the whole, even if they're not below cost timber sales, it is a subsidy in the sense that the Forest Service is doing work that the timber company would have to do on its own. And that becomes an issue later. But in this period, by and large, with some exceptions like Muir and so forth, Americans who support the Forest Service are quite content and see this as right and good that it should facilitate the use. Again, you go back to the gospel efficiency. This is about preserving natural resources for future use, not setting them aside for forever in pristine condition.
Purpose to make profit from it at all?
No, it's not primarily a revenue generating scheme. It's supposed to cover the costs of operating the agency, the system. But I was just saying, sometimes it actually is a losing proposition for the public, for the Forest Service. In the interest of time, I'll move on here and talk about ranchers. It's not just loggers who are concerned about the growing power of the Forest Service. There's also pushback against Pinchot and his program from ranchers, who, as we've talked about before, were accustomed in the late 19th and early 20th century to using the public domain and federal lands as a vast grazing commons, and without having to pay for that privilege. The Forest Service begins to impose regulations on public range ranching in the late 19th century. In 1897, the Forest Organic Act set up a system of privileged permits for ranchers with preference given to local landowners and longtime users. So the Forest Service is trying to accommodate customary uses of these lands. Initially, there's no charge. The federal government is just trying to keep track of who has how many animals on how many acres of the public forests. But the permits did limit the number of stock that you could run and also set grazing seasons. So ranchers are beginning to feel the influence of federal power. They become outraged when, in 1906, the Forest Service began charging nominal fees for the use of these grazing allotments. And to touch on your question, again, it's not really a profit or revenue generating scheme. It's meant to pay for the costs of administration. So it's a nominal fee. At that time, it was 5 cents per animal unit month. Now, you don't need to necessarily understand all the details of animal unit month, but an animal unit month, or AUM, is the amount of forage necessary to sustain an animal, either one cow or five sheep. So one cow equals five sheep. The amount of forage necessary to sustain an animal for a month, which is roughly 800 pounds of grass. So it's 5 cents per animal unit month. It's a nominal fee. It's far below what ranchers would have to pay if they were going to buy the land outright and pay taxes on it. But for ranchers who were accustomed to complete freedom on what they considered to be their land by custom, it is too much. And they begin to complain immediately about the imposition of what they call unfair taxes. They argued that they had acquired a moral right to the range, you know, through, in some cases, more than one generation of use. And so they believe it is very unfair that the federal government should have any say in how the land is used. Ultimately, they challenge this in court, and it goes to the Supreme Court in this case, Fred Light versus the United States. In 1911. The case started this way. Fred Light, who was a rancher in Colorado, allowed 500 cattle to stray onto the Holy Cross Forest Reserve. And he refused to get a permit. When the Forest Service told him to stop and charged him with trespassing, Light sued, arguing that the federal government had to fence its lands like other property owners if it wanted to protect them and keep him off. So in other words, it wasn't his fault that the animals had strayed onto the reserve. It was the federal government's fault for not fencing the lands. And this was consistent with Colorado state law and the laws of a lot of other Western states, which favored stock owners by saying, you know, if you're a property owner, it is your responsibility to protect your land from trespassing, not the trespasser's responsibility. So that was Light's argument in court, but he lost. And the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government had a right to manage forest reserves as a public trust. And you can see there Fred Light didn't think much of this. You know, he said he admits that it is his intention hereafter, as heretofore, to turn his cattle out on the unreserved public land of the United States adjoining his ranch without securing or applying for any permit. He denies that any damage will be done if they do go upon the reserve and contends that if they shall go on the reserve, the complainant is without remedy. So this is not over by a long shot. And over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st, right up to now, you'll see recurring battles between ranchers in the West, especially, and the federal government, the Forest Service, and the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, over these very issues. So again, an example of the continuity that scholars like Patty Limerick identify in Western history. I'll conclude with one final constituency that is alienated by the creation of the forest reserves, and that is Native Americans. Native Americans are themselves, as we've talked about, at odds with a variety of other groups, including loggers and ranchers, over the uses of lands that had once been theirs, and in many cases which they had reserved rights to by treaty. What you're looking at here are Yakima Indians in south central Washington state meeting with Forest Service officials in the early 1930s within what was then called the Columbia National Forest. It has since been renamed the Gifford Pinchot National Forest in honor of the father of the modern Forest Service. The issue in this case was berries, specifically huckleberries. Huckleberries are among the five sacred foods of the Washit religion, traditional religion of many Indians on the Columbia Plateau. The other sacred foods are water, salmon, game, and roots. Huckleberries are the most important berry species, which Indians traditionally migrated up into the mountains to pick in the late summer, in August, into the fall. And you can see here a Native woman in the 1930s drying huckleberries using fire. And as we know from the Forest Service's perspective, fire bad. Fire bad, like Frankenstein says. You know, you don't allow this kind of potentially dangerous blaze within a protected forest reserve. Smokey the Bear isn't around yet. He won't really come around until the 1940s and 50s. But the Forest Service, as I've said, is moving, and Pinchot is already there, toward the view that fire is a threat to forests. We now know, you know, in part because of research, you know, that's done by the Forest Service, that fire in many forest ecosystems is a vital player in keeping forests healthy, eliminating pests. You know, certain species of pine, their cones don't open unless you have heat from a fire. So the Forest Service is moving to suppress both natural and man-made fires on national forests. And I love this one because it illustrates the shameful waste weakens America. That's from the 50s. But it shows you the persistence of this conservationist ethos that allowing marketable timber to burn is a waste. I also like it because you can see the bears are praying, as any good Christian bear would do in that situation.
Smokey is.
Yes, well, he's a civilized bear. He's smarter than your average bear, like Yogi. Just conclude by saying the issue of fire and also the issue of grazing in the national forest, including the Columbia National Forest, puts Indians at odds both with other users of the forest and with the Forest Service. You can see in the words of a Yakima woman, Shaikut Nee, in 1929, fire is what makes berries. When our forefathers were here, they took care of everything. Huckleberries are an early successional plant, and they stop bearing fruit when they're overtop, when they're shaded. So as forest grows in, unless the foliage is removed, and fire is the most efficient natural way of doing that, eventually you get this. That's a picture of the Surprise Lakes campground near Mount Adams in the background there in the 1930s. I took this picture on the bottom in the 1990s. And it's the same vantage point. I didn't incidentally know about this picture when I took that one, but then I looked at it later and was like, whoa, it's the same place. And you can see what decades of fire suppression have done to the landscape. Now, if your primary purpose is to grow timber, or to provide recreational space for whites, then that's not something to worry about. But if you're native people who have camped here for generations and depend on the berries, not only for subsistence, but as part of your culture, the Forest Service's fire suppression policy is highly problematic. And you can see here in quotes from the same council that was held in the late 20s, native leaders arguing that they had reserved this place, they had reserved those berries through their treaty with the government in 1855, and that the Forest Service was violating their rights by restricting how many horses they brought in, by allowing sheep grazers onto the land, and by preventing them from burning the fields periodically to keep them open. So I'll end there by saying, you know, from the beginnings, the conservation movement, and in this case embodied by the forest system, is contested by a variety of constituencies that see their local and traditional uses of land endangered by what they regard as an overbearing federal government. On the other hand, you see the arguments of men like Pinchot and TR that a robust federal presence is necessary to protect these lands from despoliation and degradation. And those tensions will not go away, and they remain very much a part of Western politics today. And it's a theme that, again, we'll examine going forward. But now it is time to go. So thank you. And appreciate that you held your applause till the end, as always. I never applaud, but that's all right. See you guys next week. We'll finish this up.
Next week on Lectures in History, Colorado State University professor Ann Little examines the clothing worn by some colonial American women with a focus on stays, which are similar to corsets. Both male and female children at the time wore stays until around the age of 7, when males would stop wearing them, while females would continue to wear them throughout their adult lives. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcast or download the podcast from iTunes.